Yep.
I just bring it to entertain you.
Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Business Transportation Economic Development meeting. I will tell you that all the bills we have up today are just for public hearing because we have no fiscals on any of them, so we can't move them even if we want to. I've got a bunch of legislators who need to get back to business, so we're going to, let's see, is Devlin here? We'll open first on Senate Bill 219, Senator Devlin. And Representative Reed, if he's here. I don't see Tobias. No, we'll just do it. Senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. If you'll just give me about 10 seconds. I've been talking about the Early Learning Council for the last hour, and to be honest, I'm not very clear anymore. But let me talk a little bit about a bill that I think intends to be relatively clear. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for hearing this bill here today, Senate Bill 219. I became involved in the creation of this concept because of a situation that occurred in my district, I think well over a year ago. A company that is located there, Novellus, that has one of its operations there, and actually has its operations in a number of different states and actually in a number of different foreign countries, was planning to potentially bring 125 positions somewhere. And these were positions that I think on average paid more than $66,000 a year. You may know that Novellus is actually the company, one of the major companies, that actually produces the machines that actually, if you want to look at it in a simplistic fashion, actually puts the circuitry on wafers. They don't produce the wafers, but they produce the machines that put the circuitry on wafers. What happened when they came not only to me, but they came to Washington County, they came to the city of Tualatin, they came to the state of Oregon, both in terms of the Business Oregon and the governor's office, is we looked at what our options were to try to attract them to this state, because they had a number of states that they could potentially locate in, or they could even have moved their operation, these 125 positions, off to a foreign country. And if they had done that, they might actually ultimately someday move part of their operations that are in this state off to that same country. What we found is we did not have very many alternatives for them. In fact, we had practically nothing. Ultimately, after a lot of discussion, they ended up actually locating here. Now, I think the only benefit that they received is I think they received a small allotment out of the governor's, I forget the proper name for it, but the governor's investment fund. And they didn't bring 125 positions here. I believe they brought now over 150 positions here, all very good-paying positions, all positions that are paying Oregon income taxes. And those positions coming here has probably had a multiple effect in terms of the local economy, in terms of what jobs they've helped create. But after those discussions, I became convinced that we lacked a tool. And we don't really have a tool to encourage local businesses are here that are want to expand, or businesses that want to bring in jobs into this state, a true incentive in many cases. I mean, we have some incentives, but for somebody that actually simply wants to bring good-paying, high-paying jobs to this state, we have very little. The proposal that's going to be before you today still is going to need some additional work. I want to make that very clear, and I think the representatives here from Business Oregon will talk about some of that additional work. I think there will be a number of people here to testify in support, too, including Erickson Aircrane from Central Point that will be here to testify. What this concept would basically do, it's not a tax credit. It would basically have a forgivable loan. But the company that brought the positions in would have to meet certain criteria. That's actually kind of interesting because as we look at our tax credits for business, which all have kind of sometimes a clear connection between the credit and the job creation, this has an absolute connection because you actually have to create the job, you have to maintain the job, you have to pay the people at this level to get your loan forgiven ultimately and to meet the obligations that you would have under this. I think that you will find this bill to be an intriguing proposal. I think it will be a very instrumental tool in Business Oregon's toolbox, in a sense, in terms of being able to create jobs in this state and good-paying jobs. I would hope that you would give it consideration. I know that there are amendments, as I have indicated, that will be prepared, and I would hope the good chair would bring this back to the committee when those amendments are ready.
We'll just see how you do. Thank you. Questions of the senator? Thank you, Senator Devlin. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I'm sorry I was a bit late, but glad that I got to hear most of Senator Devlin's testimony. I will try not to repeat it, but simply want to add my enthusiasm for the bill and tell you a bit about my experience with it. I had the good fortune of working with the Governor's Economic Development team that was co-chaired by Treasurer Ted Wheeler and Chair of the Economic Development Commission, Wally Van Valkenburg. And we helped, I think, identify a real gap in some of the economic development tools that exist for Oregon, particularly around those mid-sized companies and particularly around companies whose major expenditures are around payroll as opposed to capital expenditures. So this is a concept that really works to try to fill that gap. It was presented at the business summit that many of us attended in December and got a good response there. Appreciate Senator Devlin's comments about the additional work that's needed and would second his request or hopes that this comes back. I'd also just like to highlight that it's a good match for the kinds of knowledge-based and innovation-based efforts that I think will be key to our future economic success, and that as it's structured, the program would end up contributing to the general fund because of the incremental tax revenues that result from the jobs that are a requirement to take advantage of this program. So I think it's a very needed tool. Commend it to you. Thanks for the chance to come testify.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Gerard.
Well, this is me for either one of you. As a rural senator, I'm trying to figure out why someone from rural Oregon should be for this bill. There seems to be a requirement of 150 employees, as you know, most of the industry and stuff. I mean, that would be for some, you know, somebody from Mill City. That's probably out of their scope. So I'm just trying to find out. Give me your best. Why someone from rural Oregon should want to vote for this bill?
I'll give it a shot, and then the good senator can clean up. Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, I think one of the things that has been most evident to me as I've considered and thought about economic development is how connected we are as an entire state, so that a job in one part of the state contributes to our shared resources that are distributed to the rest of the state. So the schools and other programs in all parts of the state are a function of our collective ability to fund them. So that's one answer. And the other, I think, is the fact that we don't know what's going to happen. It may well be, and I suspect you would be a far better advocate for your district than I would, that you might have particularly suitable attributes somewhere in your district to a kind of business that might very well want to locate somewhere in your district. I don't know the answer to that, but I think having an additional tool available to the good folks at Business Oregon increases the likelihood that a new employer or an existing employer might choose to expand in your district.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerard, if I might respond also. I think some of the modifications to the bill may address part of your issues in the sense I think the bill is structured not only for existing companies expanding, but new companies coming in. And while I know that there are not enough cases to make a very solid case for this, but there are cases for businesses coming in, not just simply into metropolitan areas or urban areas, but larger employers coming in some cases, into rural Oregon. If there are the right attributes there for them to come there. So,
Senator, there are actually some large employers in rural Oregon.
Oh, there are, but not too many. You'd like a few more, let me tell you.
Any other questions for the Senator or Representative? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you,
gentlemen. I'm going to recess on Senate Bill 219 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 217. Senator Monroe and Representative Schaffler and Smith, please.
Can I also bring up Superintendent Barbara Rommel with us, please?
Sure.
Senator, have you copies of my materials distributed? Thank you very much. I appreciate you holding this hearing today. This is an issue that I've been working on for about 20 years. In 1990, the citizens of Oregon passed Measure 5. We're all familiar with that. This has led to reasonable equalization in school funding across the state for operation. However, it has not equalized capital needs as the property value per student in the various 200 school districts varies significantly. David Douglas happens to be the second poorest district in the state in property value per assessment or in assessed value per student, and this makes it very difficult in these poor districts for them to pass a bond measure because there's a great increased tax burden on each individual homeowner. Property values are low. The burden of increased property taxes on the individual homeowner is much higher. In David Douglas is one of the fastest growing districts in the state. It is entirely within the city of Portland, but it does not share the wealth of inner Portland because it has virtually no business and industry. The largest employer in nearby David Douglas is Portland Adventist Hospital. House Bill 217 allows the City Council, at their discretion, to divert a small amount of the urban renewal dollars from inner Portland to build an elementary school and community center on land already owned by the David Douglas School District. We're asking for about $10 million out of the hundreds of millions in urban renewal funds that are there. This does not expand urban renewal in any way. It simply says that a bit of this wealth from downtown Portland ought to be shared to outer Portland where David Douglas exists. Portland School District number 1 has seen a consistent drop in the number of students, whereas David Douglas is amongst the fastest growing in the state. Class sizes are large. Schools are bursting at the seams. There's a reason for this. One of the reasons is gentrification. Actions taken in inner Portland have greatly increased housing and rental costs in inner Portland, forcing low-income families to move further and further out into the East Portland area, served by David Douglas. Over 75% of David Douglas students are eligible for free or reduced lunch, and there are over 70 languages spoken in the David Douglas schools. David Douglas is a district that has many needs and is doing an outstanding job of meeting the needs of its patrons with very little resources. The bill is absolutely permissive in nature, does not require the City Council to do anything. It simply states that diversion of the funds would be legal if they see fit to do so. Also, this bill is narrowly drafted so that it can only be used for a school/community center. I also have presented you with the -1 amendments, which makes it clear that it is only appropriate in Portland. There's language there that says that it that is defined as a large city of over 500,000. It's only one city of over 500,000. So this would only happen in Portland, does not in any way affect other special districts, does not in any way affect fire districts or any of the other special districts, is only allowable for one use and one use only, that's to build an elementary school with a community center on land already owned by the David Douglas School Districts. I'm happy today to be joined by Barbara Rommel. When I was chair of the David Douglas School Board, kind of helped to hire her, and she served as superintendent for a long time. And, of course, Representative Jefferson Smith and Representative Mike Schaffler, my colleagues representing the David Douglas District. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator, I just have one question. This relates to a non-contiguous addition of land to a urban renewal plan. I think that's the way it's written.
Yes.
Portland has a number of urban renewal plans. Would it apply to just one of them? Would they pick one, or would it pick...
Yeah, there's only one that's really large that creates hundreds of millions of dollars.
So it's just once in downtown?
This would be up to the city council, but we anticipate, and I have a letter of support from the mayor and from city commissioners that would indicate this. It would be up to them, but the anticipation is that they would take this approximately $10 million from the hundreds of million generated by the downtown urban renewal district.
Is there any issues with compression with that district?
No, there's no because this does not increase urban renewal in any way. It's not increased the amount of urban renewal dollars. Simply diverts a small amount from the wealthy area of city to the poor part of the city.
Yeah.
It's a distribution of wealth.
That'll get them.
Did you want your guest to speak next?
I definitely would like to you to hear from Barbara Ronald and from Representative Schaffler and Representative Smith.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Mike Schaffler, House District 48, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland. I've represented Southeast Portland for 9 years now, and they stretch a dollar about as far as you can, and as Ms. Rommel reminded me again today, that's why they're called the Scots. But they really do a great job with very little. They are bursting at the seams. They need just capital construction money, and I agree with my friend Senator Monroe. You know, they're generating a lot of wealth down there, and we would just like them to come out and help these folks in Southeast Portland. But I just want to, if I may, I agree with the senator over there from rural Oregon. We do need jobs all over the state, and I would love to do whatever I can to help that, too. So anything I can do to get a vote, Senator.
That's quite a trick, Senator, that you've got the representative supporting urban renewal.
Does that include a full 16-ounce beer?
Representative Smith, did you want to go next?
Less than $50.
Okay, Superintendent.
Okay. I'm Barbara Rommel. I retired last June as superintendent of the David Douglas School District after serving in that capacity for 12 years. And after 40 years total as an educator in the state of Oregon, I really appreciate Senator Monroe taking a look at trying to adjust this legislation so that we would be able to go ahead with a plan that was actually hatched at by the city commissioners in Portland to try to share some of the wealth that was generated in the very successful River District. David Douglas has seen a huge increase in enrollment. In the 12 years I was superintendent, about a third more students joined the schools of David Douglas, and to where now the district is serving over 10,000 students. So this, when this plan was proposed earlier, it ran up against some opposition by some of the members of the River District, and it got kind of sidelined, even though, as I've told people, it's not dead, it's just on life support. So hopefully this legislation, if it's approved, would allow those plans to go forward and get the go-ahead for a much-needed facility. Urban renewal is intended to enhance the community by bringing in more jobs, but all of us know that no community is complete unless it has good schools, and this would open the door to allow schools to be part of those urban renewal plans. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Representative Jefferson Smith, serving District 47 in the Oregon House. Just about everything's been said, but it hasn't been said by everyone. I will offer just a few additional facts to clarify the shift in population that's happened in the metro area. In the last, I think, 15 years of the time span, Portland Public School District, which is the large school district just to the west of the David Douglas School District, has gone from 58,000 students to 46,000 students. To give another little fact, when I was at Grant grant. We had about 1,650 students. David Douglas about the same size. David Douglas is now about 3,200 students. Right? We've seen that go from about 50% on free reduced price lunch to up to about 75 plus on free reduced price lunch. So there's been a significant growth in the area. Given that latter fact, while local bond issues are an option, they're not a sufficient option when you've got one third of the population on food stamps, for instance. So the so your attention to the bill is really valuable, really appreciated. To the extent we can move it along and work on it, that would be great. And if you have questions for the chief gang here, that's great. I'm also available.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Moving on down to Jenny.
Let's see. So we will recess on 217, and we will reopen Senate Bill 219. Are they here?
Yeah, Smith is.
Oh, well, as long as you're here, do you want to do the...
Can I get my staff out here? We thought we were going last. Can I get them real quick?
Sure. So we're still up on 219.
Did you see Paul?
No. Tim McCabe. We may bounce around here a little bit here today to get the representatives in and out.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, director of the Oregon Business Development Department, also known as Business Oregon. I'm just here in support of the bill, in support of Senator Devlin's bill, and to state that it is in the governor's recommended budget. There's $5 million set aside. I do want to stress, though, when we say this is $5 million, this is an investment in jobs in Oregon. And that's what it's geared towards. This will be recapitalized with the money that comes back in through personal income taxes paid by the company to the state, and it'll recapitalize this fund. And hopefully when I come back here 10 years from now, this fund will be at about $20 million and have created hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs.
You're going to come back here in 10 years?
Hopefully. and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Oh, I'll take a shot at this. I got to tell you, it just kind of cracks me up. We passed 66 and 67, which drives business out. We have the highest capital gains tax in the nation, and we just raised unemployment insurance 39%. And now we want to allocate $5 million to attract business. I mean, do we think that maybe we could do it in more constructive ways, like reducing the tax burden on business?
Was that a question?
Yeah, no. I was
okay. Give a response.
Senator Girard, Chair Beyer, members of the commission, I number one, as Senator Devlin said, this is more, we aim this at existing Oregon companies, of which one is here today. It's not an end-all and a cure-all for everything, but as the Senator said, we have no incentives to keep Oregon businesses here while other states are actively recruiting them. And he used Novellus as an example. Northern California, they have a facility there, or they did, and they've now relocated that facility to Oregon. But they were being attracted by them as well as other states whose tax burden is much higher than Oregon's. Right now, we're ranked as the sixth most business-friendly tax state in the nation. Not my statistics. You know, I'll present the statistics, but the governor mentioned it the other day. And do you remember the index that? No, you don't. Okay. Business taxes, we have one thing here that other states can't boast, and we have that single source sales tax, which was very appealing to Novellus because their products sell for upward of $5 million, and they don't pay a cent in sales tax on that, where it isn't true in any other state. So we have many advantages here, but taxes are always something that companies take into consideration. There is no place that is perfect, but I would say that Oregon isn't the worst place in the United States.
Well, Tim, I imagine, well, I know you do. I know you and your staff run the tax comparisons for businesses all the time. They're looking at that. What have you found in terms of the taxes? How do we stand?
Well, as I said, we helped with companies when Measure 66 and 67 were initially passed, and a lot of companies were concerned, and we helped them make those determinations because they said, do we need to move from Oregon? And we calculated the taxes for them in California, Idaho, and Washington, and Oregon is still a better place from a business tax standpoint. So we get that all the time, and one of the other questions I get is it makes it more difficult to recruit. Well, when we bring companies in and show them and do our tax comparison, we're right there with everyone else. And again, our single source sales tax, our low workers' comp rates, I will take an exception. Only one portion went up 39%. The other remained the same, and the net overall was not a 39% increase because we present those figures all the time. We're the 42nd lowest in the nation in workers' comp rates. So I think we're just very competitive from top to bottom.
Senator Rott?
Well, not to disagree, but on industries that have a high volume and a low net profit, this is a terrible state to be in right now. And you can look at the Granges and everything else and industries out in rural Oregon, and then they are really, really hurting with 66 and 67.
I think this debate could go on forever. You probably wouldn't agree at the end. Anything else, Tim?
No, I have nothing else. I would suggest, as long as we have a representative up here from Erickson Air Crane, knowing time is short, that if you right. could hear his perspective on this.
Appreciate
great.
That.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all for allowing me just a few minutes to share a little bit about Erickson Air Crane. My name is Udo Reeder. I'm the CEO of Erickson. I've been an Oregonian now about 3 years since having joined Erickson, and I'm glad to be here, and have recruited quite a few more East Coast and Southern folks to Oregon, some kicking and screaming because of some of the things that you all have just mentioned here today. So I'm for all of these benefits for companies, and this is one that I think it's before us right now, and we can do something to affect things in the very near future and affect some of the decisions that we're making at Erickson in the very near future. You all may remember Erickson mostly as a small Southern Oregon logging company that bought a few helicopters and started logging. Since then, we've grown pretty substantially. We now fly 17 of our helicopters, very high-value helicopters all around the world, 16 countries, 4 continents, and we're doing that business very, very successfully. We were acquired 3 years ago by a private equity company out of New York, and that company, and as well as myself, saw there to be great potential in this company beyond what it's currently doing. So this flying of these helicopters around the world represents today about 80% of our total dollars. There's another smaller part of our company that represents about 20% of our total dollars, and that is that we manufacture and we do maintenance, repair, and overhaul on these helicopters. That part of the business has an opportunity for very substantial growth in terms of what we see is capitalizing on selling more of our aircraft around the world. We've started down that path, and we are making good progress. We've just, as of last week, signed an MOU with China, in fact, to sell 5 of our cranes as an initial tranche to do a proof of concept in China and demonstrate how our air cranes can respond to in fact, what we've just recently seen in Japan disasters, which is exactly what we do. Also in that MOU is the notion of developing an industrial cooperation that includes potentially co-manufacturing, co-marketing, and co-support within China for the Chinese market. And therein lies our opportunity. As we develop this industrial cooperation, the market in China, we think is very substantial. They think is very substantial. So now the question is, this market size is increasing. What do we do? What do we do there? And I think that's where we have an opportunity, making us, these are business cases, and they're very simple, straightforward with private equity companies. They have to present returns for their shareholders, and so the best business case essentially wins. Our business case would be more competitive with SB 219 moved forward, in that we can potentially offer a more competitive base for increased manufacturing within Oregon. Lots of decisions have to be made, everything from where is final assembly, where do piece parts get manufactured, or some combination thereof. When you enter into the Chinese market, there's no question they want something well beyond just the helicopters. They want a piece of the business, and that we have to understand, and they want our investment, and we recognize that. But the degree to which we do that, and how many of those parts that ultimately will end up in China, or those aircraft that will ultimately end up in China, how much of that do we do here is what this bill can make us more competitive and can be influenced in the coming months.
Questions? I assume that one of the things that's of interest and valuable is the fact that Oregon has a single sales factor, income tax. Since most of your sales are external?
Yes.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Okay. Mr. Wilson. The representative is not back yet, is he? Oh, and Jeremy Rogers as well.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries in support of Senate Bill 219. Just quickly, we're in support of the bill. My CEO was the CEO of the Tulsa Chamber, who has great experience with this type of program in Oklahoma, saw the investment it spurred in that state, and so consequently we support 219. We think Business Oregon should have more tools, not less. It is clear that they don't have the tools needed to generate the kind of investment that we would like, and so we would like to arm them with more tools. We support a culture of innovative programs to attract business. We think that 219 is in line with that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, Jeremy Rogers, representing the Oregon Business Plan. We included the concept behind Senate Bill 219 in the Oregon Business Plan because two primary reasons. One, we heard from the economic development community that this was a critical tool missing from the toolbox, one that could be applied based on high levels of employment and wages, not just based on high levels of capital expenditures. And given the goal to raise incomes in the state above the national average, I think providing that kind of tool is significant. The other thing was a study that was done by commissioned by the Business Development Department, benchmarking Oregon's economic development toolbox and incentives against other states. And that study also showed that this was a clear gap for the state of Oregon. Just want to reiterate, it's not a tax credit, so it's not something that can just grow beyond what we intended. It's allowed to be applied at the discretion of Business Oregon and the governor's office. And so I think really, while there's a lot of issues affecting business competitiveness, job growth, income growth, and I appreciate the comments from Senator Girard as well as the comments from Tim McCabe about the assets we do have here, this is really a separate issue. It's just trying to provide a new tool that will allow our economic developers to really be competitive with other places, and we support that. Thank you.
Questions of this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Jack Eskelman and Sarah Garrison. Whoever wants to go first.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Eskelman, appearing before you today on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. Before I start my testimony, let me reiterate an invitation you should have already received in your offices. It is OETA Day in the Capitol, and starting at 4 o'clock down in Hearing Room 50, you and your staff are invited to come down and meet some of our members. We have about 70 members from the state in the building, and they have a number of pieces there, and we'll be able to interact with you and talk to you about the work they're doing throughout the state to promote job creation. Our legislative agenda puts at its forefront the protection and enhancement of economic development incentives. This Senate Bill 219 would come under the heading of enhancements of economic development incentives. It's important to note the state hasn't created a new monetary incentive for job retention and recruitment in quite some time, probably approaching 20 years. And for that reason, we'd urge your support of Senate Bill 219. And joining me is Sarah Garrison. She is one of OETA's members who works in the Economic Development Department at the City of Hillsborough. She can talk to you a little bit about how this bill would work in her community.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Garrison. I'm the Economic Development Manager at the City of Hillsborough. I want to support Senate Bill 219, and please accept this testimony to do so. This concept really does provide a new tool in our economic development toolbox. It helps companies expand and create new jobs in Oregon. It really meets an identified gap in those tools that we have had at our disposal. We do have tools such as the Enterprise Zone that is really for capital-intensive investment. That is the investment companies make in the land, the building, the high-tech equipment and machinery. What we don't have is a tool that helps companies that are investing in the high-wage workers, what I would call the smart workers, the scientists, the researchers, the software developers, these people that are performing those essential economic development functions that help our companies create new inventions, new products and services, and that keep them competitive in the global economy. So as we embrace this information age, which we all have with our iPods and Facebook, et cetera, this investment in the people and the knowledge become even more important. This program is targeted at existing Oregon companies, in particular, to keep and grow those knowledge-based industries where there's really opportunities for significant growth and the opportunities for generating increased revenue for Oregon. I would call this the innovation economic development strategy versus what we typically think of as the traditional industrial recruitment strategy. This program provides an incentive that really is a departure from that traditional industrial recruitment. I believe that this industrial recruitment model of the past is becoming obsolete given the logic of low-cost production in other areas such as China. It's the new open global economy. So this is the difference between manufacturing a widget and moving that overseas to the low-cost environment or constantly innovating and developing new products and enhancements with these smart people and this investment in the knowledge-based economy. I do think that there is a different economic development strategy for Oregon, which we're calling innovation economics or this knowledge-based economic development, and this is a tool to help us get there. City of Hillsborough supports this bill and modifications down the road. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up for Senate Bill 219. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this one?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It's a good bill. That's the extent of my testimony.
You're on the record, Senator. We will close public hearing on Senate Bill 219, and I see Representative Smith is back. So we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 930. Representative Smith, Representative Edwards, did you wish to testify as well?
Sure.
And I don't see is Representative Jensen here. He is not.
I believe his aide is sending him forthwith.
Whenever you're ready, whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator from North Eugene, West Eugene, and Junction City, here in support of Senate Bill 930, also known as the Economic Gardening Bill. Funny name, good concept. I first was introduced to the concept by Representative Smith and became intrigued as somebody that generally thinks that we need to do more of a lot of these things that we're talking about in this committee, not only today but on other days. I think our economic development professionals in the state need more tools and they need more resources, and I think it's really needs more budgetary focus. But when we look at the tools, there are certainly different philosophies about how we ought to approach economic development. And it's been alluded, we've alluded to the headhunting model, where you go out and you look for big companies and lure them to your state to set up shop. We have all sorts of tools for doing that, some of which are tax breaks and tax incentives. And frankly, I'm not necessarily opposed to using those tools. I mean, I would like to have Hynix back running in my district and providing good, high-paying jobs. But when we look at some of the areas from which we have the greatest opportunity for job growth, it is those small companies that are kind of through their first stage of growth, getting established, and they're really poised to take the next step. And they are experts in whatever area of service or widget it is that they produce, but they may or may not have, and oftentimes they do not have, expertise in other core competencies that are needed to really propel their company growth forward. That might be marketing and demographics research. It might be GIS expertise, web and search engine expertise, database development. A lot of these things that you see in big, sophisticated companies that have whole divisions and whole departments that do that type of thing. Certainly, the entrepreneurs in Oregon may not have that in their companies, but if they did, or if they had access to those kind of tools, one can only imagine what they might be able to do in growing their companies. And it's certainly, we need those type of folks, those people with the energy and the passion and the focus on their particular core competencies. We need them to be empowered to take the next step and to help grow the economy into the future. So that is what economic gardening is all about, how we bring those, marshal those resources as a community, as a state, and make them available at a cost that is affordable to small companies, to not only show them what they might be able to do, but I think in many instances the entrepreneur that is an expert in their field may not know what they don't know. And certainly the economic gardening concept and the programs entailed within can help them. So, and thereby help the whole state, because we're all in this together. We all need to get people back to work. And so with that, I will turn it over to Representative Smith.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Long time no see. For the record, Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the Oregon House. With the Chair's leave, I'll be really brief here, and then some people came from a little further distance to testify, and I can offer a little more and maybe answer questions. We can answer questions after they're done. I'll just cue it up by saying this. I think probably in this committee, certainly in the similar committee on which I sit in the other chamber, we hear very often the line, we could attract more business to Oregon if we would just do blank, right? And very much less often do we hear, we could grow more business, grow more jobs in Oregon if we would just do blank. And I think the people who know economic development, know the private sector, are less afflicted by that mistaken talking point than a policymaker like me. And at the same time, I think there is room for shift in some of our awareness based on a couple of facts. One, we know that from 1998 to 2008, stage one and stage two companies, like, you know, the kind of companies that Senator Rod, I think, was you were hinting at on a previous bill, not the 150 plus, but sort of the 1 to 100, those companies have grown jobs significantly in that 10-year period, whereas larger companies lost jobs. Larger companies still a critical job provider, but haven't been the growth driver. Similarly, resident companies in that same time period grew 17%, had their job base see growth of 17%, while non-resident firms saw a decline in jobs of about 3%. So a focus on homegrown business, and particularly homegrown business with growth potential, seems like a really important area of priority. The story and there's Representative Jensen. Where some of this thinking began was Littleton, Colorado, where they had their largest employer exit town and made the strategic decision that rather than replacing that employer and trying to hunt around for a replacement, they would invest in the companies that they had. And they saw over the next period of years, saw a double plus 37% growth in their job base, a tripling of their sales tax revenue, and became kind of a national story, and since then programs have kicked out. Beaverton has been doing a thing. The regional partners have been doing a thing. You'll hear some about that, and I won't belabor that. Florida started their program, Grow Florida. They just came out with their economic analysis of that. We have copies of that for the committee members. They, with a relatively modest investment, created 1,400 plus jobs at just a couple few thousand dollars per job. When you compare that to the stimulus package passed by the president for whom I voted, of $92,000 a job, even if Florida is fudging their numbers by a factor of 4X, it is still a really helpful and a high ROI investment. In the last special session, the Stage 2 Economic Development Task Force was formed to bring forward some findings and recommendations. I won't offer those. I think we have some testifiers from that task force who can do that. But to give you a rough idea of what we're talking about, it's helping homegrown companies get access to market intelligence so they can find more customers and find new markets. And we have an example of such a company here today. In terms of how we might implement such a thing, we want to leave it up to the discretion of Business Oregon, I think. But one leading option to respond to the potential question about how to serve the entire state, make sure it's not just an urban core program, would be to have the Small Business Development Centers of 19 centers around the state do an intergovernmental agreement with Oregon State University, who has extension schools in 35 counties around the state. Also at OSU, they have the Austin Program for Entrepreneurship, as well as an on-campus market research firm called Close to the Customer, which is funded by fee-for-service, generally charges $25,000 to $250,000 per contract, and mostly serves out-of-Oregon companies. And using some of those core competencies, I think we could stitch together something that was really effective, had a high return on investment. Before we go any further, I'll turn it over to other folks who want to testify and can say more or less or respond to questions later.
So, Representative Jensen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity and the privilege to come here and testify to this committee on what I think is a pretty outstanding piece of legislation, and one I hope that we can continue to work with here in the state of Oregon. For the record, my name is Bob Jensen, state representative from Pendleton, Oregon. That's House District 58, otherwise known as Roundup Country. For those of you who haven't had the opportunity, education in Oregon is fairly limited.
I think we have the travel council bill up later.
I'm sorry, I got the wrong bill. Darn it.
You're doing your own economic gardening.
That's what it's about here. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I was kind of brought into this arena and this bill kicking and screaming a little bit by my good friend and representative from the metropolitan area, Representative Smith. I really consented originally to be involved with this because, first off, I've run for the legislature now for 7 times. In all 7 of those elections, the campaign theme seems to have been across the state, jobs, jobs, jobs. And if you wanted to sweeten it up a little bit, you referred to it maybe as living wage jobs. But be that as it may, we've had in Oregon something of a significant issue with creation of jobs, and I believe this is one very viable alternative to be looking at. I have a little bit of experience in this jobs market as far as industry is concerned. I was a member, a partner in a company that worked during the late 1970s and 1980s helping companies utilize jobs programs. Specifically, some names that would ring bells for some of us, the JTPA, the Targeted Job Tax Credit Program, etc. Wound up being a relatively successful company. I can't say that the programs themselves wound up to be wildly successful. They were, however, at least the Targeted Job Tax Credit Program was a mine for a lot of businesses in this country, and in being and paying some attention to it at that time, and subsequently, the idea of the economic gardening is one that fundamentally makes very good sense. It's to grow your own industry. And not to worry so much about what was good for somebody else. At any rate, I've been on monitoring the task force over the past few months since the last legislative session. I've been impressed with everything that's going on. I think it's a win-win situation, and I would encourage your very serious consideration of what you're being proposed here today. Thank you.
Representative, questions in this panel?
Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Burke.
You forgot to mention Happy Canyon.
That is a very serious mistake, and my good friend and colleague from the Portland area has a special invitation to the 95th anniversary of the Happy Canyon show next year.
Thank you.
Isn't that a watering hole?
I was fishing for that.
Thank you very much. Let's see, do I have a sheet on this?
You're about to.
Hmm?
You're about to have a sheet.
I'm about to have a sheet. Oh, I've got a whole bunch of people coming up here. I'll bet you this is Valerie Plummer, Michael Gurton?
Gurton, yes.
David Beam and Tony Tom?
Michael Gurton.
Gurton. All right.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Plummer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Microenterprise Network. I also serve as the Chair of the Economic Gardening Task Force, well known as Grow Oregon Task Force. Be really brief and give some time for folks that we have here to talk with you about what we're discovering via the Economic Gardening Task Force. We've discovered, to echo Representative Smith, we discovered that a real small proportion of Oregon companies is creating most of the jobs in the state. And those firms tend to have 100 or fewer employees and tend to be younger firms with 3 to 5 years of age. I'm passing out to you the Economic Gardening Task Force findings and recommendations that list these fully, but I'll just point out a few highlights. One, the Economic Gardening Strategy includes a few sort of key strategies that we've discovered haven't really been utilized as a tool in the economic development toolbox, including advanced market research and competitive intelligence, geographic information services, website search engine optimization, as well as CEO roundtables and strategy so that CEOs can connect with one another. We discovered that the strategy of economic gardening is working in other areas as well. Representative Smith mentioned the city of Littleton, also the Portland-Vancouver Regional Partners Program, city of Beaverton, as well as the Grow Florida Program. We're recommending that criteria for identifying companies that would be good candidates for this service include smaller companies, those that have 10 to 99 employees, revenues between $1 million and $50 million, that they are traded sector companies. In other words, they're doing business outside of Oregon and bringing new wealth into the state, as well as those that have positive revenue trends the last 3 to 5 years. And we really do want to see that this program, if successful, does touch all 36 counties, so it's not just a metro area program. As part of the findings and recommendations, there's a matrix of services, and that really indicates what we've seen as a gap in services that could be provided to these high-growth companies, those companies that really should be laser-targeted to create as many jobs as possible in Oregon. So that's a real brief overview of the findings and recommendations. And we're going to hear from Michael Girton to give you kind of a under-the-hood view of how economic gardening does work in reality. Here you go.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Girton. I run the MarketLink program at the Oregon Microenterprise Network. We provide economic gardening research to the Portland-Vancouver Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program, a program that has served 32nd stage companies in the Portland metro region last year, with market research focused on growing revenues, bringing wealth to the state. I'm here to take you under the hood of our economic gardening program, as well as discuss the work that was done for Tony and Randy Tom of Keyscaper. And Tony Tom will be speaking about the impact of the work after me. In developing our economic gardening program, it was our goal to enhance, not add an extra layer to our members' pre-existing economic development efforts. To that point, it was important to develop a program that was both easy to roll out and easy for growing businesses to access. To begin providing EG services, economic gardening services, to local businesses, the procedure is rather simple. I meet with city representatives, I do a database search of businesses that meet the parameters, and combine that with their on-the-ground knowledge of businesses that are growing in their region. The businesses are contacted by the economic development people in this city, and then we follow up with a meeting in person for about an hour where we learn about what the business, what their needs are for research. They fill out a one-page application form. I return to the office, and in about 10 days, we complete the report for them, send it to the business, and follow up with them to see if they have any questions or need further work from us. 6 months after receiving the work, and this is the only string attached to this program, is we recontact all businesses and give them a survey so we can track the impact of the work on them in regards to whether it's increased their revenues, any jobs hired, capital expenditures, and also their belief on what percent of that growth was due to the work that we provided. An example of how well-integrated economic gardening is to pre-existing economic development efforts can be found in the city of Tualatin, the home of Keyscaper. In Tualatin, the city economic development employee, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, and a representative local bank and I all visit the companies together. This concerted, coordinated effort is impactful for businesses. It shows that their community is representing them, is there for them, and it also provides synergy and networking opportunities for the business. In cities like Tualatin and the 8 other municipalities we have served in the past year, economic gardening services were complementary to existing efforts, provided members new tools to help their local businesses, and were in no way duplicative of existing services. You should have a report in front of you that I prepared for Keyscaper. It is a really strong example of how economic gardening can impact a business. Randy and Tony Tom are experienced business owners. They have an industrial printing company called Strategic Printing, and from that company they rolled out a spin-off company where they are printing and branding onto keyboards, iPhone covers, and mice pad, or actual mice. And it's an opportunity for companies or NCA teams to brand onto a keyboard. When I met with them, they their experience had in the past been dealing with other businesses. This was a product that was meant for consumers, and you're about to see the Keyscaper work right now. They, with this product, it wasn't playing to their strengths. So the work that you have, the report in front of you, in short, it details an industry analysis for Keyscaper, and it reveals that there are sales channels besides the direct-to-consumer that they were looking at that could provide them with opportunities to sell their product successfully. And a little bit later, Tony Tom will be talking about the impact of the work that we did for her.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is David Beam. I'm the Economic Development Planner for the City of Newburgh. I'm also the chair of the Portland-Vancouver Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program, and I'm also on the State Economic Gardening Task Force. Economic gardening generally is implemented on the local level. However, it is a scalable economic development strategy. A good example of that locally is what Michael just referred to, the Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program. We've worked on that the last couple of years. Last year, we only implemented our pilot program and served about 30 companies, and we're just now getting into the surveying of those companies to find out the impact of the program itself, but the preliminary analysis is quite promising. As you'll also hear from Keyscaper, they're quite successful. The program can also be done scaled up to a statewide level as well. The best example of that is the Florida. About 2 years ago, they began an economic gardening program on a statewide level called Grow Florida. Through that program, they budgeted about $1.5 million for the first year pilot program. Through that program, they served about 200 companies. Recently, an outside contractor did an analysis of the impacts of that program. They used the basis of the analysis was a software program called M-Plan, which does economic development impact analysis. I believe Business Oregon uses that to gauge the impacts of some of the projects that they do. And you have that report in front of you. The important parts, but were showing that the impacts were pretty strong. As Senator or Representative Smith alluded to, they indicate that it led to approximately 1,450 jobs. 600 of those jobs were direct job creations. About 400 of that was indirect job creations, and about 450 of that was induced job creations. So if you do the math on that, you'll come to about $3,000 per job for a direct job creation, or $1,000 per job for all the jobs that were created. In addition, it indicates that this program stimulated an additional $281 million of economic development activity into the local economies of Florida. So, in my opinion, this is a pretty dramatic impact and a good return of investment of economic development dollars. That's not just my opinion, I don't believe, but the governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, was so impressed with this program that this year he devoted a significant increase in their budget this year to expand the program. So why was the Grow FL program so successful? Obviously, many, many different reasons, but I think there's a couple elements that they did that made it really important to be successful. One was they were true to the economic gardening principles. This is not your traditional business retention expansion program. It is very focused. It is focused on assisting second stage traded sector companies that have potential for very high growth, and with that, their success You'll bring in a lot more wealth into the state as well as create jobs for your citizens. Secondly, they hired very qualified staff. Not everybody can do this kind of work. People who staff this type of program need to have very good soft skills. They need to know how to have the right temperament, how to deal with these type of businesses. And they obviously need good technical people as well to do the research. And finally, these programs are very autonomous. They work, and so that they can do their job and do it well. This and all the other factors, you know, will create a program that, again, will bring a good return on your investment for economic development resources. Oregon has a good continuum of economic development services. However, I do believe that economic gardening fills a much-needed gap in that continuum and will bring you a good return on investment. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 930, and through that, show a good faith in the abilities of the entrepreneurial abilities of Oregonians and a good investment into the future of our citizens. So with that, we'll let Tony talk about Keyscaper.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Tom, and I am the CEO of Strategic Printing and Manufacturing Solutions. We started out primarily as a job shop for high-tech industry, plastic molders, medical, and dental manufacturers. We have a lot of experience with that industry, and we knew how to bring those products to market. Towards the end of 2009, we introduced a new product line, which was Keyscaper. We started out with keyboards and mice that were custom printed. This involved an entirely new customer base with an entirely different set of rules. Because of this, we struggled with how to bring this product to market and whose advice we should heed. Sales were lower than we hoped while we were investing money from our industrial division and then also our personal funds as the recession deepened. Because of the recession and the immense amount of energy required to keep our core business going, we had neither the time nor the resources to do our own market research. Also, because of the timing, like many other small businesses, our confidence was at an all-time low and we were susceptible to bad advice. Then, in April of 2010, the City of Tualatin contacted me to introduce me to Michael Gerton of the Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program. At first, to be quite honest, I was a little unsure about the program because I'd had some negative interactions with other state agencies, so I wanted nothing to do with bureaucracy. The fact, though, that somebody from the city said that they would come out and be with us made me figure that I had nothing to lose. The meeting started with a tour of our facility during which we showed Michael all of our products and discussed our strengths and weaknesses. By the end of that meeting, it became apparent to me that Michael was perceptive and knowledgeable, and I felt hopeful. By the next business day, Michael had emailed me with a list of subjects he felt he should research for us, and his list was spot on. Within a couple of weeks, we received a report from Michael that helped us make some necessary changes in our marketing plan. He included a SWOT analysis that further showed that he understood the situation, we could trust his advice. And I believe they've passed out that analysis, so if anybody wants to see the specifics. But basically, we were targeting the wrong market, and we were using the wrong channels to ever get into the correct markets. We utilized his specific information and suggestions, and we started to make changes. We tightened the rules with the reps we were using, and we eventually ended those relationships. We started targeting the markets that Michael had suggested, and we, by October, we were selling into Best Buy and other outlets. significantly, our Keyscaper revenue went from a few thousand dollars a month to tens of thousands of dollars. By October, sales of the keyboards and mice were actually $75,000, and that does not include any other sales of banners or other products that come from that division. That entire division sales for that month was $140,000. In addition, Michael introduced us to another Oregon company, Ovation Works. They're a promotional products company with whom we have now partnered. Through them, we are selling to such companies as Google and Boeing. Because of the increase in sales and royalties that we are giving our licensors, we've also been able to get approval from them to market additional products, which I know Michael talked about, the iPhone and iPad cases. We get those blanks from a company in California, and because they're close to us, we can do other products they carry, such things as Kindle covers and Droid covers, so if demand exists, we can do that quickly. The sales of the keyboards are still somewhat cyclical because you are getting items that are stocked for specific seasons. But fortunately, it appears that the cycles of that division and our industrial division are complementary, and we've been able to maintain steady employment. Because of this success, our confidence is up not only in this division, but our industrial division. We've been able to provide our employees now with full employment and even overtime, and we've hired more people. Since last summer, we have hired 11 people that are regular on our employees, and we've also, like as of today, we had 5 leased employees from a temporary agency. This is a small number, but it's relatively quite large because we started out with 25 to 30 employees. It's important to note that these 11 people were primarily on unemployment before we hired them, or else they were in jobs for which they were overqualified, and now they've freed up those jobs for people who are on unemployment. I'm also hearing from our employees that they are planning vacations. They are taking on home improvement projects. They're shopping and eating out because they feel more confident. So they are adding dollars to the Oregon economy, and that's what this program is really about. The state of Oregon has high unemployment, and I know that as a small business owner, I take my responsibility to my employees very seriously. My employees and their families are counting on me to make good decisions to help keep them employed. And I'm not the only business owner that feels that way. Other business owners feel it too, and it's very frightening to be alone and not have resources to help you make those decisions. The Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program gave me the support that I needed, and I wish there were more programs like this. We need programs that provide education and knowledge, not that bail businesses out with money that is not monitored and might have very little long-term effect on employment rates. A program such as the Regional Partners Economic Gardening Program that helps business owners keep Oregonians employed is a positive investment in our state's future, reaping benefits many times over. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Let's see here. I'm curious, show of hands, how many, this is all I had to testify on this. Is there anybody else who, okay, can I hold you up for just a second here then? I'm going to recess temporarily on Senate Bill 930. We were scheduled to do a information report on the highway fund, but I think we're going to have to gavel in and gavel out of that one because we're not going to have adequate time to do that. So, Senator, I will allow you to
go ahead first. Oh, yes, you're already in. There we go. Goodbye, Senator Girard. Hello, Senator Moss.
Okay. Gavelin's up to me.
I'll call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order as a subcommittee with myself and Senator Morse. We were supposed to have a joint meeting today, and this hearing went on longer than intended.
And we have more to go.
So we will adjourn this meeting till a later time.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your indulgence.
Not a problem.
So we will get to this report. We'll still have one more time.
I will be there.
Okay, we will reopen on Senate Bill 930, and you wish to testify? Please.
Thank you very much. I'm Caroline Bauman with the Economic Development Alliance of Lincoln County. I'm here as a part of the OEDA conference that we held earlier today. But I just want to give a very brief message because I do think that economic gardening, that my county, Lincoln County, could really benefit from this type of focus or program. We possibly could benefit from it. Lincoln County is on the coast, as people know. It's not on a transportation corridor. It is not close to any interstate. And we also don't have a workforce base of 50,000 or more. And we also don't have any flat land for development. So when it comes to traditional manufacturing sector, we don't have it at all. You know, our economy is fishing, tourism, and wood products. But we do have an entrepreneurial spirit in the type of people that live on the Oregon coast. We also have a very desirable place to live. So as an economic developer, it makes it quite a challenge for me to see how can I help foster the entrepreneurial spirit that we do have. We have a types of businesses that are not just small businesses, but very small. And I think that the potential of economic gardening is that we will be able to seek out and find those few businesses that maybe have built the world's greatest fishing net, which we actually do have in our county, is the person who invented the type of apparatus net to catch crab, and the Dungeness crab industry is now considered a sustainable industry. It's very exciting. But to identify the people that might make a difference in the traded sector and help them grow through the Small Business Development Department administering this program, I think it could be very easily done. A small investment that might help my county. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sure. The department.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department, and just wanted to note that the panel that was before you today presented at our commission meeting last Friday here in Salem, and the presentation was very well received. And we continue, as we're named in the bill, to have discussions with the proponents of the bill and to work with them to identify funding and other options to help, you know, provide this service so that it meets a need that has been identified along the continuum of services and programs that we work with and administer at Business Oregon.
Any questions of Paul? Thank you, Paul. Anybody else? Seeing none, we will close on Senate Bill 930 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 673. Richard.
Senate Bill 673 removes limitations on payments for funding cost-effective energy conservation measures by large retail electricity consumer. It removes limitations on large retail electricity customer receiving direct benefit from energy conservation measures. It declares an emergency. There's no revenue impact, but we haven't yet received a fiscal.
Okay, let's see. Fred Hett? Okay. Fred, I can't remember how to pronounce your last name.
Hewitt.
Looks like a V. I'm sorry.
I'm Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Fred Hewitt.
I'm representing today the Northwest Energy Coalition, which is an alliance of more than 100 environmental, civic, and human service organizations, progressive utilities, and businesses in the four Northwest states and British Columbia. We provide promote development of renewable energy and energy efficiency, consumer protection, low-income energy assistance, and restoration of fish and wildlife in the Columbia and Snake River region. We're very pleased to appear in support of your committee's bill, Senate Bill 673. The bill may seem on the surface to be modest, but in fact it will have a rather large, important impact. The region has had a very successful 30 years of promoting energy efficiency as our cheapest, fastest, most available resource. And the industrial sector, which this bill addresses in particular, is a very important segment of that effort. In the last 30 years in the Northwest, we've saved about 4,000 megawatts of energy, which is about the equivalent of eight full-size power plants. And industrial energy efficiency has been a major effort in that. It's no exaggeration to say the Northwest is a leader globally in industrial energy efficiency. Going forward, in the next 20 years, the Power Council proposes or estimates nearly 6,000 total megawatts of energy efficiency is available. Again, much of it would be from the industrial sector. So Oregon can play a major role in this going forward, and we think that Senate Bill 673 will help that in a significant way. For example, in Portland General Electric's current integrated resource plan, using numbers from the Energy Trust of Oregon, they estimate the potential in the industrial sector for energy efficiency of 223 megawatts during the next 20 years. That's 49%, just about half of the total energy efficiency available in the PGE service territory. One half of one large power plant, a really significant amount of power. These are investments that make economic sense. They have to be done in a careful and collaborative way. Senate Bill 673 opens the door in that direction, helps remove a procedural limitation we now have. The bill provides for thorough scrutiny and transparency under our existing Oregon processes and helps bring about those things that Oregonians care a great deal about in these times, to build our economy and expand employment, to decrease our dependence on energy sources outside our region, and to protect the environment. Senate Bill 673 will help pull all the pieces together, and we thank you and support the bill.
Thank you, Fred. Any questions, Fred? Okay, Mr. Kendall.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Mark Kendall with Kendall Energy Consulting, and I'm here based on my role this past year as staff to the Oregon Global Warming Commission and supporting their industrial task force that was focusing on industrial strategies to achieve Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions reductions of 10% below 1990 levels by 2020 and 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. And our task and the industrial work committee's task was to identify the cost-effective opportunities in the industrial sector in Oregon that would enable us to achieve those reductions. And it was clear through all of the research that there are substantial opportunities for energy efficiency to accomplish the goals that you just heard about, which are virtually parallel with the Northwest Power Planning Council, plus substantive cost reductions in and energy savings in direct gas use in industry. Over 2,000 industrial energy analysis, comprehensive of all range and size of industrial facilities, have been completed across the United States in a variety of industries, many of which are represented here in Oregon, and they were sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy and co-funded by the industries themselves. And there is no less than 15% average energy savings opportunity in those industries that have rates of return of between 10 and 20%.
and that rate of investment in Oregon, somewhere in the range of $500 million between now and 2020, would yield energy cost savings to these industries of approximately $150 million per year. We've heard that Oregon has routinely and regularly been a champion and aggressive with its investment in energy efficiency, and industry has definitely stepped into that challenge over the years. But what we find is that Oregon's electric utility rates and costs for energy are less than national average, and that puts Oregon industry on a cost per commodity basis in competitive position, and it doesn't compel a substantial capital reinvestment in energy efficiency when the returns are longer because of the low cost of energy as a cost of doing business. So there are substantial benefits for all ratepayers. This is an opportunity to leverage a very small ratepayer incentive to encourage some of our most cost-effective energy efficiency resource available to us at this time. And it will put us on trend to be heading in the right direction to accomplish this body's legislative direction on reducing global warming gas emissions. So with that, I think I'll let other people provide similar or other testimony. And
thank you, Mark. Questions to Mark?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, pardon my ignorance.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Pardon my ignorance, but this would basically remove the 3% cap.
That's right. Correct. There is the.
So what would be the cap? There's no cap in the bill.
Head shaking, Mr. Chair. Well, apparently, we're getting head shakes off in the audience. Others who disagree, but
they disagree. I would have. I'd rather defer that the answer to that to others. But right now, there is the 3% cap on public purpose charges. I think the Public Utility Commission has authority to raise that.
I think what Mark's trying to say is that the 3% is the public purpose charge under 1149. There was
correct.
A bill that the legislature passed in 07, I think it was,
yes.
Senate Bill 838, which allowed the PUC at the utility's request to increase a charge for conservation on top of the public purpose charge if they deemed that it was the cheapest way to meet energy demand. That bill specifically excluded large industrial customers.
Oh, and so this would bring them back.
And I think what this is allowing them the opportunity to participate once again.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
I think some others might see that differently.
I just needed a little bit of plain English. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Now, I have three people bracketed here. Does that mean you want to come up together? There's a line. I don't know. I have Mr. Early, Margie Harris from the Energy Trust, who I asked to come and be available, and Marion Hayes from PG. Oh, why don't y'all come on up same time? Margie, I know you have no position on this because you're not allowed to, but I ask you in terms of to just provide some education for the committee in terms of what would this bill do if it was an act? I believe we're still talking self-direct if it was there.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Margie Harris. I'm the executive director of the Energy Trust of Oregon. And as the good chairman said, Energy Trust has no position on this or any other pending legislation, and we are here at your invitation. I'm going to cover very quickly a few points. To summarize them, Energy Trust has had great success serving large customers of utilities that would be impacted by this legislation. We invest in the least expensive energy available to meet the future requirements of utilities and their customers. That least expensive source is energy efficiency. It's about four times less than investing in other conventional fossil fuel plants. We predict that we will run out of current funding from large industrial customers over the next 2 to 3 years. That funding is limited to Senate Bill 1149, our enabling legislation, and we have been honoring the historical funding that we've had under that bill and not increasing that baseline, even though Senate Bill 838 exists for residential and commercial customers. So we do have an imposed cap on the amount of funding available for large customers. We would be fine, we predict, for the next 2 to 3 years, with the one exception, and that exception is important. If we get a very large customer project and opportunity coming in the door, two of which are on the table now for discussion, we could tip over our annual budget, and that would pose some other challenges for us. We could run out of annual budgeting for this category of customers, or we could leave those savings opportunities coming in the door on the table. Such savings from large customers are often the cheapest savings that we could buy at the highest volume. So that's one of the concerns. Those concerns were identified in our strategic plan, and we've been in discussions with many people about them, including our board of directors and Michael Early, who's here to testify. One thing I do want to point out is that since 2007, when Senate Bill 838 passed, we've been very engaged in working with each of the four utilities on their future plans and needs and ways of achieving energy efficiency. We have identified that energy efficiency from large customers, which include both commercial and industrial customers, is very advantageous, and that we would need to secure additional funding from that customer base if we were to meet the goals of the utilities at the lowest possible cost. Why don't I stop there and see if there are any other questions for me, and give time for other people to testify.
Why don't we go ahead and let them finish and then see if there's questions. Marianne?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Haynes, and I'm representing Portland General Electric. As has been discussed earlier, with the 838 additional tariff funds in 2007, PGE really took an active role in identifying the need for and advocating for additional energy efficiency funding in order to meet the targets that were laid out in our IRP. As part of that, we worked with both industrial and commercial customers and worked on including this 3% cap that applied to the large industrial customers who were at the time worried about additional costs, and also working with commercial customers who prior to that weren't getting an amount commensurate back for projects and what they were putting in. More of it was going to industrials, and so there was an equity issue there. Given our role in 838 funds and advocating for that, we don't support changing the 3% cap at this time, and do not support Senate Bill 673. Again, I don't want to indicate that that's not that we don't support funding for all cost-effective energy efficiency measures. We do. That's why we came in supporting the additional 838 funds. It's also important to note that for our system, we don't need the additional 838 funds right now for large industrial customers in order to meet the targets that are in our IRP. We recognize that won't last forever. There may be a need in the future, and we'd be open to that conversation at a time when it proves that those funds would be needed, but for now we don't support this bill moving forward. Thank you.
Michael.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Senators. I'm Michael B. Early, the Executive Director of the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. I'm here to oppose this bill today. I think the Chair fairly represented the history of this issue. Our concern is that the same reasons that led the legislature in 2007 to continue to exclude industrial customers more than one average megawatt from additional potentially open-ended conservation funding remain viable today, that there's no compelling reason today to grant additional authority to collect additional conservation funds from customer. Just by way of background, I want to impress upon the committee members that we are paying significant amounts toward industrial conservation. Rates have increased significantly since 1999 when the conservation charge went into place, and as rates go up, so the revenues collected under the 3% increase, and in fact industrial rates have gone up by a larger percentage than other rates. So we are contributing significant amounts. Plus, we're also achieving significant amounts of conservation. If you look at one of the attachments to my testimony is a report to the legislature that reflects conservation savings in the 18 months ending June of last year. And if you look on the summary page there, you can see that the industrial conservation is making a significant contribution to the overall savings to the region, particularly if you look at the self-direct piece, which is available only to customers in this class. It's contributing in this period of time more than half of the more than its fair share of conservation savings in that period. Secondly, I want to respond to the discussion that rates in the Northwest are low, and industrial rates in the region are low, and we can easily absorb an additional charge. Also attached to my testimony is a report from summary from the Edison Electric Institute, which ranks industrial rates of 160-odd investor-owned utilities across the country and ranks them from highest to lowest. And you'll see that the perception that all investor-owned utility rates in the Northwest are low compared to other regions is simply not true anymore. So the bottom line is there's no compelling reason today to make this change. And I think it's unwise to grant authority, particularly regulatory authority, before there is a need for that, for the exercise of that authority. And then following up on Margie's comments, in fact, part of what we're seeing increasingly is that to the extent a lot of the additional industrial conservation that's being found and expected to be found is behavioral change, conservation due to behavioral change. It's not particularly capital intensive, so even though the numbers may be large, it may not translate into a linear increase in the number of funds that need to be available to obtain that conservation. Finally and lastly, the 3% charge, there is a self-direct option, which is very important for the industrial sector, and we would certainly argue when the time comes to talk about additional conservation funding that the self-direct option be available to these members. Thank you.
Questions of the panel? Seeing none, thank you. Jeff Fishnet.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities working on electricity, natural gas, and telecommunications issues. And I just wanted to say a couple words about Senate Bill 673 from the perspective of customers that are in fact involved in what are called 838 tariff processes. And we have found 838 to be a very viable tool in supplementing the public purpose charge. To be very clear, this does not do anything to the public purpose charge. It maintains the public purpose charge would be maintained as kind of the base funding. What is asked as part of these processes is as additional savings are identified that may or may not have to be left on the table, the question that's put before the PUC is, is it cost effective to go after these particular savings with at this amount of money and have that amount of money be put into rates to go acquire those savings? And we have been through now about three, maybe four tariff processes under 838, and it's, as with every process at the PUC, a very rigorous process. And where we've been able to raise questions to be very clear on what we are paying for, what we're not paying for. I think it's the key issue is, you know, we don't see the need today, but do we, you know, do we want to sort of wait until the opportunity is before us, or let an opportunity or two or three pass before we decide to do the policy? A couple of thoughts that occurred to me in listening to the discussion is maybe this is something, if the committee wants to move forward on this, to look at a period on down the line where there is some consensus between the utility, the customers, the energy trust, and it's maybe a period of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years that we put this into effect. Also, Mr. Early made reference to the self-direct function under the under Senate Bill 1149. I see no reason not to mirror that here if the committee wanted to do that. I think that is a very important option that the industrial customers have, and one that should be included here if the bill goes forward. With that, that concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions?
Thank you
very much. That is all I have on my sheet. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this one? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 673, and we will open on Senate Bill 217. I have, let's see, five people. Barbara Rommel? Don't see Barbara. Ann Hannis?
In addition to this, we have Barbara Cartmill.
Sure. Great. Get a threefer.
It's getting late in the afternoon,
yeah.
So I'll make it easy for you.
ALC Special Districts in Aora. Whoever wants to start.
Why don't you two start?
I'll start. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the Executive Officer for Clackamas County Fire District No. 1, and I'm here representing SDAO. We are sensitive to the plight of David Douglas School District and what they're facing and what they have faced in the future, and we're also sensitive to the comments of Senator Monroe and Representative Shoffler. But we'd like to say that we oppose this bill, and there are several reasons why. First, I'd like to go into a little bit of the history of urban renewal legislation in the state of Oregon. For the last decade or so, up until the 2009 legislative session, different parties in with an interest in urban renewal were literally at war, and that the battles took place virtually every other year in the in these hearing rooms, and it became very, very difficult for parties on both sides. In 2009. The parties got together prior to the legislative session, worked very, very hard with very disparate interests and very disparate groups, and as a result of that effort, came to an agreement on some changes to urban renewal. And I would say those changes are probably the most significant urban renewal legislative changes that have taken place since 1996, when Measures 47 and 50 were passed. So those changes to urban renewal did a couple of things. First, they allowed urban renewal agencies to return dollars. They allowed urban renewal agencies to make some go through a different decision-making process when they renewed an urban renewal plan. But most importantly, what the legislators told us is that they didn't want to see us back again. They were tired of the battles too. So the legislative leadership said, you guys figure out what you need to do to fix it, and then let's have detente for a number of years. So we all agreed that we would not come back to the table asking for more urban renewal changes, and we also agreed that we would oppose any urban renewal changes that came to the table. So that peace treaty was signed in 2009, and I would say that peace treaty was signed by all of the major players in urban renewal: Multnomah and Clackamas County, Aora, League of Cities, the counties, Tualatin Valley Fire, Clackamas Fire, City of Portland PDC, and others. So with that peace treaty in mind, we feel obligated to oppose any changes to urban renewal.
Apparently the City of Portland had a change of heart.
Well, I'm not speaking for the City of Portland right now. I'm speaking on the history of urban renewal. So even if the peace treaty did not exist, we would still believe that this is a bad legislation. First, there are different ways that we think that David Douglas could solve its problem without this change in legislation. We think that because of the 2009 legislation, the City of Portland could just take some of that excess value that it has in some of its urban renewal district, return that value to the tax rolls, which it's now allowed to do, and the amount of money that the City of Portland gets from that as an overlapping district, it could simply give to David Douglas School District. It does not have to go through this process. Second, the City of Portland could simply close one of its urban renewal districts and return that value to the tax rolls and take some of Portland's share and give that to David Douglas School District. Third, in that area around David Douglas School District, the City of Portland could simply establish an urban renewal area. There's no need to have a satellite urban renewal area that's not contiguous to the primary assessed value. So this process of transferring money from a wealthy area to a depressed area or blighted area even is a little bit flawed. And it's flawed first because we are concerned that those investments really don't lead to increased values, which is what urban renewal is supposed to do. Second, and this affects me personally, as a City of Portland taxpayer, a certain number of my taxes that are supposed to go to Portland Public Schools are diverted to an urban renewal area. Now, if this bill were to be passed, those tax revenues would be further diverted to yet a different school district. So what you would have is Portland Public School taxpayers ultimately paying taxes that would be spent in David Douglas School District, and we think that's just bad policy. I think I'll stop there. Again, I want to reiterate that we're sympathetic to David Douglas's plight. We think there are other options other than this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Cartmill, and I'm the president of the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. My testimony is on behalf of AORA and is in opposition to House Bill 217. As an urban renewal agency and practitioner, it might be expected that we'd support legislation that expands urban renewal authority. That's not the case. Senate Bill 217 permits urban renewal plans to include school construction or reconstruction projects. Under current law, urban renewal plans may include school construction or reconstruction as a public building. Senate Bill 217 permits urban renewal plans to add certain non-contiguous lands to an urban renewal area. There is potential with such a practice for tax increment financing to be spent on projects throughout the municipality unrelated to the goals of the original urban renewal plan and district. Even if the bill only applies to one municipality, by creating an exception, the public will voice concerns over how urban renewal operates. All urban renewal districts will become open to criticism and lack of trust. Senate Bill 217 places a 20-year limit on outside estimated date for project completion to an urban renewal plan. As Mr. Gorman indicated, through House Bill 3056, which we enacted in 2009, we placed limits on maximum indebtedness and amendments to maximum indebtedness, all of which will guarantee reasonable return on revenues to the taxing districts. There's not another need for an additional time limit to be added. Those are the major points. I would reiterate again what Mr. Gorman said as far as the work we did in 2009. It was an extensive look into actions in the statutes that would not have far-reaching implications that could hopefully be controlled and monitored. That was the object of that, so that individuals weren't coming back, changes to fix this for me, change that to fix that for me, this constant turmoil and upheaval and lack of knowledge as to what was moving forward and what was dependable, what you could look at and depend on. So with that, I would close my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Ditto.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes of the Association of Oregon Counties. House Bill 3056 from last session was strongly supported by AOC, and we were a signatory to the peace treaty. And in good faith of that peace treaty, I'm here to urge you to give some time to give time for House Bill 3056 to work before we make any further changes.
Thank you. Any questions? No questions. Thanks very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 217? Well, we will close the public hearing on 217. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.